March 2nd, and we're doing Hashkafa. And the question we're taking up is a very interesting question pertaining to additions. It's clear that one is not permitted to make any alterations in the Torah. And the Rambam brings this down in Hilchos Yisori HaTorah. That is, one is not permitted to add to it or to subtract from it. In Perek Tishi, the Perek Shemini and Perek Tishi, the last three chapters of Hilchos Yisori HaTorah are very important. And maybe in the coming month we'll make a more systematic study of them. So, actually, Perek Shavi, I think. Yeah, from Perek Shavi and on, he takes up the subject of Nevuah. Then he takes up the subject of the Nevuah of Moshe. And that's where he goes into the foundation. The foundation of the Torah, of our conviction in the veracity of the Torah. So the last four chapters of Yisodei HaTorah are very, very important. Now in Perek Tishi, he says that it's a Dava Bora Umeforosh, Batorah. It's something clear and explicit in the Torah. Shehi Mitzvah Omedes La'olam U'li'ol Me'olam. That it exists eternally. It's a very interesting expression. Of course, the most important point he's trying to communicate is that there cannot be any change in the Torah. This is extremely important, and this halacha itself is a refutation of all of the other religions of the world, which claim that there is, even those which affirm the validity of Sinai and all of the major religions, all the different branches of Christianity and Islam, start out by affirming the validity of Sinai, of what they call the Old Testament or the Bible, whatever word you want to use. But they go on to maintain, of course, if that's the case, so why don't you live according to the Torah? Which doesn't mean you have to keep the mitzvot. But it does mean that whatever it prescribes for you, because the Torah has a code for non-Jews. But you see, they go on to create a completely different religion, which they then go ahead and claim has the validity of being a revelation. Now that is absolutely false. We don't recognize the validity of any other religious. Yeah? Hello? I am in here! All right, sorry. What?
He has to go into the bathroom to measure.
So let him go.
Okay, you could go.
Okay. So that, yeah. Go ahead.
What if someone were to say that to maintain this doctrine that the Torah is eternal and can never change?
Yeah.
Is contrary to the idea of God being omnipotent.
Why? Why? I'm not sure. To the contrary, God being, I don't see the question. God being omnipotent is fully in line. It's fully in line with the eternity of the Torah. I'm not getting your question. We're saying the Torah is perfect, and it comes from a being who's perfect.
It is. If according to somebody else, they might say, if God is truly omnipotent and he has every right and power within his hands, then therefore, should one day he say, you know what, I'm going to reject the Torah and I'm going to give a new Torah to another nation, that that's within his power to do so, because he's omnipotent.
Yeah, but one thing. But why would he do so? What would be the reason for doing so? I'm sorry? The reason... Just 1 second. Adam. You're asking a question on it. First of all, I'm not getting the question as to why it contradicts. I mean, God, it's not that God. Again. All right. Hello, Adam.
You're coming in and out, but I think we hear you.
Well, I'm on a landline. I'm not in a cell. Some of them did not write these ideas namely or necessarily to refute other claims. It does have the function of refuting those claims, but this is part of the Mishnah Torah. Everything the Rambam wrote over here is foundational, and this is in Yesod HaTorah. These are foundational doctrines. And the reason why he's bringing it in this context is these are very, very important Rambams, because for whatever reason, Jews are not familiar with these Rambams. And many Jews don't have a clear idea. Even rabbis today, and even some rabbis who consider themselves to be Orthodox or modern Orthodox, are willing to give some type of credibility to Christianity or even to Islam, which I think is absolute contrary to the Torah. And I think it borders, that type of narrative borders on kfira, what I would call kfira in one of these principles, or a lack of knowledge of the principle. Let's pursue this a little bit further. Again, he quotes a few more psukim. Vaniglos lonu ulvanenu ad olam. Again, the same idea. Vaniglos means that which has been revealed. The revelation is for us and our children forever. Lasos es kol divrei haTorah hazos. To do, to fulfill all the words of this Torah. Holamadata, you thus learn, shekol divrei Torah, that all the words of Torah, mitzuvin anu lasosan ad olam, were commanded to keep them eternally, forever. Again, ad olam over here, does that mean eternally, or does it mean forever means as long as the world will exist? Certainly, as long as the world will exist, as long as mankind will exist, so they'll need to live in accordance with revelation, and that will be this Torah. As I said, it's a separate issue whether the Rambam believes that the world as we know it will exist eternally. That is, of course, it didn't. It was created in time, obviously. It does not exist eternally from the outset. But once it's been created, is it the will of God that it should continue eternally? All right, but that's not our issue. V'cheinu Omer, and he quotes another source, Chukas Olam L'dorosechem. It is a eternal statute for the generations. V'nemar, another pasuk. This is a very important pasuk. Lo b'shamayim hi. The Torah is not in heaven. Which is used for many purposes, not just to refute the idea of a new revelation, but even if someone should claim that a particular interpretation, something from the oral law, is to be changed, or it's not correct, or even to try to resolve a machlokas in terms of the oral law, that too is absolutely prohibited because of lo b'shamayim hi. Now, and even knowing a particular halacha is not in heaven. It's all given. The idea being is that the revelation, this is the imagery in terms of understanding this pasuk. The revelation was in heaven, so to speak, that is before it was given to man. God has, so to speak, a revelation, and he wanted to give it to mankind. He gave it to mankind, and that's it. It's not in heaven anymore. It's in our hands. In our hands, with regard to the written law, with regard to all the mitzvos, but even more, with regard to the interpretation, with regard to the oral law. There's a system. The system of resolving disputes is not in heaven. God will not intervene to paskin a shaila. And he leaves that to us. And even if we were to get it wrong, which, I mean, it's not, the way the Torah is structured is not wrong, because if you follow the system, then whatever the rabbis at that time, adhering to the rules and principles that God gave over to us, if they reach a certain conclusion, that's the conclusion. It is possible that it's the wrong one. That is, wrong in the sense of what the objective absolute truth of that halacha would be. But it's right in terms of Torah observance. And God will not intervene. God will not send a prophet to correct the Sanhedrin about a particular interpretation or a halacha or any of the enactments that they make. So he says, Halamadata, thus you learn, She'ein Navi Rashoi L'chadeish Davar Me'ata, that no Navi is permitted to be Mechadeish Davar, to propound something new. Anything that's not part of the Torah that we have, to propound something new, that is, to come to us with a new revelation, which would be some kind of an amendment to the Torah, one way or the other, on any particular level, he's not permitted to do so. Lefichach, therefore, im yamod ish, if a man should arise, bein Yisrael, bein min ha'umos, whether from Israel or from the nations. Now this is very significant because the Rambam apparently in saying this maintains that it's conceivable that there could be a Navi from the Umos. That is, what he's going to show us is that this prophet who violates this principle is a false prophet. But in including a Navi from the Umos, from the nations, it would appear that the Rambam holds that we could have Nevi'im from the nations. And we would, if they passed the tests and they were adjudged to be true prophets, then we would have to listen to them. It's an interesting point. But anyways, that's not his point over here. And he says, V'yasa os umofes. And he should perform a sign or a wonder. V'yomar, and he would say, Shashem shlocho, that God sent him, lahosif mitzvah, to add a mitzvah. O ligroa mitzvah, or to subtract. Okay, so that's one type of a change. A new mitzvah, or a removing of a mitzvah. O lefaresh b'mitzvah min a mitzvah. So even if you did not do that, did not come to eliminate or add, but to explain, to interpret one of the mitzvos. Perush Shaloshamanu Mimoshe, an explanation which we didn't hear from Moshe. Questions being raised about people today that don't operate in accordance with the Torah Shebaal Peh, the basic principles of the Torah Shebaal Peh, and they reject certain parts of it. But they do so with the idea that there's some kind of a higher knowledge or higher wisdom or other factors operating. For example, the issue of, we've just been discussing, the issue of sleeping in the sukkah, which is a very, very, it's an interesting study of how the Jewish people relate to the mitzvah of sukkah these days. Now, anyone who studies the area, you don't have to be a big scholar to know that the mitzvah, of course, is to dwell in the sukkah. And every source mentions that the two primary activities, there are primary and secondary activities, the primary activities which demand sukkah, which can't be done outside of the sukkah. The secondary activities of dira are activities which enhance one's dira, but could be done outside. For example, yeah, friends, eating peros, fruits. Fruits does not absolutely require the sukkah, because a person will eat fruits on the run. It's not necessarily connected with dira. But the two primary activities are eating, and eating too is more, there's more leniency in the eating part, because that's only if you're eating a fixed meal, which involves a certain amount of kvios, which involves a certain amount of bread. As we said, snacks may be eaten outside. But when it comes to sleep, it's an absolute. And even what they call shidas haroi, even a minor sleep, like a nap, demands sukkah. And it's usher to sleep outside the sukkah. Yet you see, well, aside from the fact that many people are a little bit lenient in this area. Okay, now among those who are lenient in this area, there's two kinds. Part of the problem is that for many years, especially in Europe, the weather was cold. And that's legitimate, because there's a principle of mitzdayer. And if the objective conditions are such that they cause pain, so in that situation, the person is mitzdayer, and he's exempt from sukkah. Now, many people have gotten lazy, perhaps. It's uncomfortable, they don't want to sleep in the sukkah, so they could sort of push that mitzdayer button and say that they're not comfortable. That's one issue. Of course, when a person builds a sukkah, he has to see to it that it contains what's needed to sleep, provided that it's not, obviously, if it's raining, yipata, or it's too cold. But there's a separate doctrine of those, especially the Lubavitchers, that reject the whole notion of sleeping altogether and claim that they're not supposed to and maintain that it's legitimate. Because I don't know it's taught to follow the doctrine. It has to do with the fact that there's some kind of a holiness in the sukkah, a certain light, and being mitzdayer to sleep because of the holiness of the place, so on and so forth. Now, I just responded to that, and I'm not responding to the person. I'm talking about if anybody were to come, any person were to come and make a claim like that, you're not allowed to sleep in the sukkah because you're in pain because it violates the holiness of the place and so on and so forth. We would explain to him that that's absolutely false. That's not the way the Masorah has brought down the halacha. And that is, whatever the holiness of the sukkah, whatever its designation, it was designed to incorporate these kinds of activities. So of course one is not only permitted, one's obliged to sleep in the sukkah, and it doesn't violate any sense of holiness. So if a person were to insist that it bothers him so much that he can't even relate to that, then he's basically saying he can't relate to the idea of the mitzvah. It's like a person saying that the matzah is so holy, how can you eat it? Let's say a person were to put forward that argument, that this matzah reflects the ideas and the exodus, and they left in a hurry, and so on and so forth. To him, matzah is so significant that he can't envision eating a thing like this. How can you eat something which is so holy? If a person were to maintain that doctrine, we'd explain to him that it's false, that that's not what the Masorah has taught us. To the contrary, it's supposed to be eaten. And the fact that it's an object of mitzvah, yeah, it's an object of mitzvah, and the mitzvah is to eat it. And it doesn't preclude the idea of eating it. Now, if a person were to insist that his view is different, and he has a completely different concept of the holiness of matzah, we'd say he's a kofar. We would call him a kofar. Because he's denying, that would be like a Christian would come along and give his own interpretation. So he's creating his own religion. That's a separate point, but he's distorting the true religion. He's distorting the accepted Masorah. And if he were to insist that he has no choice, there's no way he can even control himself on this, so then we would say that he has a mental disorder. And so it's not his fault, but it's a mental disorder. Because he's not in his right mind. So that's the way... That's the seriousness of these types of things and certain types of religious practices which either are contrary to fundamentals of Torah, to fundamentals of Judaism. They can violate some of the practices, like magical, superstitious, and mystical, etc., which violate fundamentals, principles of the Torah, and also violate the Masorah by putting in place a different form of practice which is not in line with the true Masorah. In effect, negating a mitzvah, because this is what you're doing here, is you're negating a mitzvah, because you're educating everyone to maintain that you're not supposed to sleep in the sukkah, which is tearing down, uprooting a mitzvah. That's a very, very serious thing. See, that's why I hold that sleeping in the sukkah today has tremendous significance. I've told this to my congregants in Plainview, and I'll be mentioning it out here as well. First of all, to do the mitzvah properly and fulfill mitzvah sukkah. But in addition, I think that this aspect of the mitzvah was pretty much lost. Because I remember as a child that hardly anybody would sleep in the sukkah. And the sense we had was that it's only for like very religious people to do that. But we don't do it anymore, that kind of thing. We don't do it anymore. So that was a falsification. It led to a certain falsification. And thus, by doing it and teaching others to do it and showing, you're bringing back the mitzvah. I think that's a tremendous merit to participate in the reestablishment of a mitzvah which, due to disuse or other historical factors, has, so to speak, gone out of vogue. A mitzvah shouldn't be forgotten. So, if this prophet performs an oath, performs a sign, so he's a qualified person to be a prophet. Obviously, if the person is not qualified to be a prophet, then we don't have Navi Sheker, because he's just a nut. We wouldn't take him seriously. We're talking about someone who has to be taken seriously, who has the capability of being a Navi. Or he says that those mitzvos that we were commanded in, that Israel was commanded in, are not li'olam u'ladori doros. Okay, so one situation is where he wants to change a mitzvah. The second one is where he wants to make an alteration in the pirush of the mitzvah. And the third one is when he says that it's not eternal. Ela mitzvos lefi zman hayu. But the mitzvos were temporal. Hareza navi sheker. This is a false prophet. Sharei ba lahakhish nevuaso shel Moshe. Because he has come to falsify, to contradict the nevuah of Moshe. Umisaso b'chenek. And he receives the death penalty of chenek. Al shehezid ledaber b'shem Hashem. Because he arrogantly spoke in the name of God, asher lo tzivahu, that which God did not command him. So that's the whole essence of the parsha of the Navi Sheker. And it's serious because the effect of it would be to undermine and to weaken the binding force of the Nevuah of Moshe. Falsification. That's one of the greatest dangers. That has been the great evil of history. The false prophecy. False prophecy has been responsible for all the devastation, misleading of people. Because, especially given that all the peoples recognized the truth of the Torah, and then they went ahead and then they proceeded to try and falsify. The objective is that all of mankind should recognize Torah. What stands in the way is the preponderance of false prophecy. And the world has not gotten the hang of it. How to recognize a true prophet from a false prophet. Shehu Baruch Shemo Tziva L'Moshe, because he, blessed be he, commanded Moshe Shem Mitzvah Zos Lanu Ulvanenu Ad Olam, that this is eternal for us and our children forever. V'lo Ish Keil V'Chazev, and God is not a man who deceives, Kazav, who speaks falsely. And this Navi refutes that, comes to refute that principle. It goes without saying, it's so obvious, it should be obvious to everyone, that all the other religions must be, by definition, false. Can't be the slightest basis. And I don't believe that their prophets, what they ascribe to Muhammad or to Jesus, I don't believe that they had any real validity. They weren't in any way, shape, or form close to being on the level of being prophets. But even if they were to have performed miracles, even if they were, which is I say they weren't, but it doesn't matter. It didn't matter to me, no matter what they did. By definition, they're false prophets because they claim that the Torah was abrogated and that they were sent to promulgate something new, and that whatever it is, it's the will of God that mankind should live according to a different religion. And thus, this one is abrogated. This one is not eternal, and so on and so forth. Therefore, they must, by definition, be false prophets. Now, that's a simple point, but I think it's important that everybody should review these points. Unfortunately, from time to time, you see that there are rabbis out there, and then even among those who regard themselves as being Orthodox, modern Orthodox, that speak highly or admiringly of the Christianity, whatever. And you always have to reinforce, there's definitely no basis whatsoever. The entire thing is absolute sheker, absolute falsehood. That's the attitude that a Torah Jew has to have. Now, of course, you have to be intelligent. It's March 3rd, and we're doing Hashkafa in the morning at the yeshiva. So we're continuing with the discussion. We took up the issue of the eternal character of the Torah, and that the Torah is perfect and cannot be tampered with via adding to the Torah or subtracting, whether it be a completely new mitzvah or removing an entire mitzvah or making any changes at all within the framework of a particular mitzvah. That is that, for example, instead of keeping Pesach for 7 days, a person will say, God sent him, he's a Navi, whatever, to keep it for 6 days or 5 days, or to extend it, and things of that sort. All of that would be absolutely prohibited, according to the Torah. We're not taking up the issue of rabbinic ordinances, and because one could, that's a big question. That is, the way we're observing many of the mitzvot today, virtually all the mitzvot, they have rabbinic components. That is Shabbos. How many of the prohibitions on Shabbos are the Rabbanan? Gzeros, Takanos, and so on and so forth. Minhagim, the tremendous amount of what we observe is Midrabbanan. And one could ask the question, well, what right do they have to do that? Well, just Purim, for example. Purim is a completely new mitzvah. It's a mitzvah midrabbanan. To observe a day, they created a holiday. And a mitzvah of reading the Megillah. The same is true by Hanukkah. So that's dealt with by the Rambam. And we're not going into all the particularities of that now. But the general idea is that that's incorporated in the Torah itself. That God gave them the authority. So, I just want to clarify. That idea that there are different necessities in different times may require certain stringencies and so on and so forth, that's foreseen by the Torah. The Torah itself can't be changed. But the rabbis, the authorized rabbis, have the right to institute, to enforce, or to see to it that the Torah is being observed properly. That's an absolute necessity. And there's a need in different times to have ordinances, decrees, and so on and so forth, to meet the needs of the time. Thus, by Shabbos or by Kashrus, due to the nature of people, that they may come to violate the laws of the Torah, so the rabbis are given the authority to make decrees and to prohibit things that could lead a person. That's one type of legislation. But all of that is rabbinic legislation whose purpose is to not to create a new body of legislation, not to create a new Torah, but to facilitate the keeping of God's Torah, Zichru Torah's Moshe. And the main characteristic, the absolute requirement, is that they make it absolutely clear that this is the Rabbanan. They can't claim that this is from the Torah, or that there's any change in the Torah itself. So it's a separate body of legislation that is apart from the Torah. They even have the power to create a new holiday, but that's rabbinic. It's based upon, another thing that is extremely important to remember, is that only the Chacham have the power to do this, because there, all of the takanos is Kain Dioraisa. It has to be rooted in Dioraisa. It can't be a separate idea that they have. That's why everything is traced back. Where is that found in the Torah? They'll find the source in the Torah. The source they find is not legislating that particular law, but it's the basis. That is, the idea is contained in the Torah. So, for example, the idea of Chanukah and Purim is based on the Torah. Az Yoshe Moshe, after the miracle. So when the Jews experience a miracle, so there's an obligation of praise, of giving praise to Hashem. And same is true in Chanukah. The same is, that's why you make the bracha. Hashem Kedishanu B'mitzvosav. Every rabbinic mitzvah is preceded by the bracha, and the bracha is saying that God commanded us. And the Gemara asks, Heichan Sivanu, where did God command us? And the answer is, Lo Sasser, that you should, the Torah itself says, do not turn away from everything that they command you. So God has authorized them to make these types of legislations. Of course, they're subjected to certain rules too in the creation of this legislation. But it's important to mention it at this point, that that does not constitute the prohibition of adding or subtracting. Now let's get to the question that was raised. What about a person, an individual, who wants to make some of his own rules in order to help him, keep the Torah properly? What is that permitted, or it's not permitted? Is that an issue of adding? Or I guess in general, what should one's attitude be towards that? Okay. The Rambam in Hilchos Deos, Perek Shlishi. In the first two chapters, he at great length goes through the doctrine. I guess it's translated as the golden means. Well, however, just a rough translation. That is to say, with regard to all of a person's amidos, his dispositions should always be in the center, so to speak, that he should seek. That's the Derech Hashem, the way of God. The Derech of perfection is that with regard to man's instinctual, emotional dispositions, and he says that there are so many of them in the various areas, ego, aggressiveness, materialistic, ambition, lust, eating, etc. All these different appetites. What is the proper approach? How should a person mold his personality? Now, I'm not talking about the regular personality. I'm talking about a different kind of personality now. We'll just use the word the spiritual personality, for want of a better term. So the Rambam elucidates the doctrine that the person should strive to have his disposition where he's in the middle, where he lives in accordance with the what we would call the principle of moderation. That is, not to be attached to either extreme. And of course, what constitutes extremes? On one side, you have two extremes. You have the extreme of indulgence, and you have the extreme of denial. And the Rambam is saying either one is, both of them are wrong. And that a person should strive to be at equidistant in the center, the central position. I guess why it's called moderation. Now, I'm not taking up the many questions that pertain to that, because how do you measure that? What constitutes an extreme and what constitutes the center? It's not, we're talking about a room you can measure and then you can discover the center, but how do you measure these kinds of things? So that's another good question. So that's a subject that has to be studied. But let's put that aside for the time being. And let's turn to chapter 3, where he says that lest the person say that since taiva is desire, kavod is honor, the chayotze behen, and the like, derech roahein, that's an evil path, to live one's life on the principle of taiva and honor, pursuing honor. Umotzin es adam min ha'olam, and they take the person out of the world. What's the difference between derech ra and motzin es adam min ha'olam? Derech ra means that intrinsically it's the wrong way. But just because something is the wrong way doesn't necessarily mean that it takes a person out of the world. It's the wrong way in terms of what the good of life is. And thus, a person who is seeking the good who's seeking perfection should not pursue it. But that doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to take a person out of the world. For example, if a person really enjoyed fishing and he devoted his entire life to fishing, just making up a cave, and he set up whatever he needed, he was in the right places with the right boat and lakes, etc. So there's nothing wrong with fishing intrinsically, but to say that that's the whole purpose of your life, in that sense, I would say it's a bad path, because you're taking something which is not the purpose for which man was created, and you're making that into your whole essence. But I wouldn't say necessarily that it's motzin es ha'adam min olam. The guy could enjoy it. It might be very pleasant. It might be very enjoyable. But just because it's pleasant and enjoyable, of course, doesn't make it the right thing to do. But then there are certain things that are the wrong thing to do, A, but B, it takes you out of the world, which means it's a practical. Practically speaking, it's not a life. And you can look around you and see that people that are engaged in lust, endless lust, it leads a person into tremendous conflict. And eventually it destroys his life. You see these big Hollywood stars and how they reach a certain point and they become completely obsessed with lust, lustful, every possible enjoyment. And they get into depression, they get into drugs, and eventually they just die because of the dangers they expose themselves to. A person who's always pursuing honor, it's contrary to the order of things. He's always going to be disappointed and he's going to have a miserable kind of a life. That's what the Rambam means. So now the Rambam continues the thought. Lest the person say, Ephrosh mehen bioser. So then I'll add, this is, I think, the question that Jonah is raising. I'll go beyond what the Torah has commanded me. Because the Rambam said that with regard to these things, one should indulge in moderation. And I'll go to the other extreme, meaning the extreme of negation, of denial. Achalo yochal basar, so he'll stop eating meat. Velo yishdayayin, and he won't drink wine. Velo yisaisha, and he won't marry. Now, you'll raise a question. Right, what do you mean he won't marry? He has to marry because of the mitzvah of Puravu. Why would the Rambam include that? It's clear that he's not allowed to do that. It's interesting that he lists this among the other ones. The other ones, in and of themselves, one could say, there's no compelling reason why a person must eat meat. According to that, there's no mitzvah to eat meat. Oh, you could say in terms of Karban Pesach, things of that sort, or on Yom Tov, fine. But still a person, even a person could, you could modify that and say, the person will say, I'll only eat meat when it's a mitzvah, which won't be very frequently, and it's just basically a kazayas. So a person can go the whole year. Well, now we don't have the Karban Pesach, we don't have karbanos. So the only time you're really mandated is on Yom Tov. Even Shabbos is oneg, it's not necessarily meat, but even if you want to throw in Shabbos, So the person will say, I'll only eat meat when it's a mitzvah, but other than that, I'll never eat meat. So that's something which halachically would be doable. It's interesting why he includes that he won't marry. But let's see. Then he says, well, yeshev b'dira no'ah. He won't live in a nice habitation. Because all this is materialism. He doesn't want to get involved in that. Well, Yilbash Malbashna, he won't wear nice clothing, comfortable clothing. Interesting. That's something beneficial to a person. It's a certain enjoyment to wear nice. He doesn't mention only nice and comfortable. Ela hasak vatsemer hakosha. He'll wear sackcloth or rough wool. V'chayote behen. And the like. Kigon kumrei edom. Like the priests. Here he mentions Edom. Seems like it's a reference to the Christian priests. So not only is he mentioning, he's saying that there is a group of people that have this notion, religious people. So what's the person saying? And I think it goes to the heart of what Jonah is talking about, that these things are bad for you. Even though the Torah did not demand that I wear those garments. But since that these things, the materialistic and the indulgence is bad, so I'll go to the extreme. It's pretty much akin to the question that's been raised. Like, why bother? Let me just ignore the whole thing. Give it up. If I give it up, so I'm not going to have a problem. So the Rambam says, Gamzu derech rohi. This too is an evil path. This is a very, very significant Rambam. The Asur Lelech Ba. And it's prohibited to follow this way. This derech. It's a derech. It's evil. And it's a very strong word. And it's prohibited to follow it. That is to become an ascetic. Asceticism, thus, according to the Rambam, is Asur min HaTorah. Hamahalech b'derech zu nikra chote. One who embraces this path is called a sinner. Harehu omer b'nazir. It says by the Nazir. Now the Nazir is someone who took a vow to abstain, basically just to abstain from wine. It's prohibited for him to come in contact with the mace, and he has to let his hair grow. But he's referred to as a sinner, because at the conclusion of the Nazirus, he has to bring karbanos. And one of them is a chatas, which is a sin offering. And the pasuk in Bamidbar says, V'chiper alav me'asher chata al ha'nefesh. And it will atone for him in that he sinned against his soul. So, of course, the question is, what was his sin? He made it, Nazirus is in the Torah. It's a mitzvah of the Torah. One has the right to take the vow of Nazirus. And now he's complying and he's bringing the karbanos. So there's different interpretations as to what the sin is. But the Rambam quotes Chazal. Amru Chacham said, Umo im Nazir shelo peresh ela min hayayin. If the Nazir, who only separated from Yayin, Tzarech Kapara, requires a Kapara, Hamonea atzmo mikol davar, one who prevents himself from everything, from every enjoyment. Alachas kama v'kama, how much more so? So you see that it's not simplistic. It's not simplistic, and the idea of abstention, that somehow or other it's wrong to indulge pleasures, and that if one does so, it's not the best thing. And thus, the more one abstains, the holier that person is, that's contrary to the Torah. Yet that's a very, very powerful unspoken, it's a very powerful emotional sense that people have. In the religious, you know, the Jewish religious literature, I'm not saying all, but it's a very, you know, the real Haredi type attitude. It's a certain attitude that the person is a tzaddik. He hardly partakes of anything in this world. The involvement in this world is looked down and is frowned upon. They're not going to say it's, I mean, obviously, it's not usher, but it may be necessary, etc., etc., but the real holy people are the ones that don't need much. And the ones that constantly afflict themselves, the idea that if one afflicts oneself with denial, that this is a service of Hashem. The Rambam is calling it a sin and a derech ra. What's the reason for this, of course? What's the reason? Why? Well, there's two questions. First of all, what's the attraction? You see, it's a very powerful attraction. And you see, it's a fundamental of Christianity. I think the religion in general. Religions in general. The world's concept of a truly religious person is of some type of an otherworldly person. He's removed from this world. He's in a different zone. He doesn't have these pleasures. That's a lower level. We're at a lower level. We partake of these pleasures, but he's a holy person, as though he does not have a body, as though he doesn't have bodily needs. And I think that's the fundamental of why it's a sin, because it's a denial of human nature. And it's a denial of the will of Hashem, that man should perfect himself, and part of the, he has to take cognizance of the fact that he's not an angel, that he's a physical being with physical needs, and the perfection itself has to be one which addresses itself. There's a Torah way in which a person should deal with the physical aspect of his existence, and he's denying that. And it's also an egotistical phenomenon, because he's trying to elevate himself into being something that he's not. We're not saying that it, the Rambam talks about this, we're not saying that it's never necessary to go to the extreme of denial. The Rambam talks about that. That's what he calls a chuli hanefesh, someone who has acquired an illness of the soul, in which he's completely taken over, so to speak. He's gone to the other extreme, and he's completely absorbed in the extreme of indulgence. And then he prescribes a cure, and the basic cure does involve, at the outset, that he go to the other extreme, not as a permanent. Indeed, that's the basic understanding of the Nazir. Because you could ask, so if that's the case, if the rabbis said that the Nazir is a sinner, so then why did the Torah have a mitzvah of Nazirus altogether? The Torah is not going to prescribe an approach that's really a sin. The Ramban has a different view, but along the lines of the Rambam, which he quotes the Chachamim, that it's not the Nazir does not represent the ideal, because there's a denial. Then that would be the idea, that the person should only become a Nazir because he needs to go to the other extreme to uproot the evil attachment from his soul. So it's a temporary measure. The Rambam does talk about that. But that's not the ordinary way. That's not the correct approach in a general way. That's like any person, for example, I mean, a person should eat rationally, nutritionally, and also should be cognizant of keeping the weight. You know, obesity is a huge problem. Huge, huge problem in America today. It's very, very extensive. It shows, it's never been this way. It's always been a problem, but I don't think it's ever been as bad. The inability of people to control themselves, to control their desires, is it's a serious problem. Now, when a person is suffering from that, he may have to go to the other extreme temporarily, like some kind of a fasting diet, or whether you just have these shakes, whatever, assuming that it's okay, the doctor okays it. Shouldn't kill himself in the attempt to cure himself. So then, let's say the person loses the desired weight. But that now, the ideal is that he should put himself on a program which makes sense. And eat the amount that is healthy for him, but not overeat. So That idea is true, that there may be situations in which it's necessary for a person to go to an extreme, either because he suffered, he's an alcoholic, he became addicted, so to speak, and he has to remove it. The ultimate goal, however, is to return to the path of moderation. Now, if a person, it could be, this is a good indicator in terms of Jonah's question. If you're dealing with a situation where a person knows himself and he says that, I agree with the idea that moderation would be good, but when it comes to this particular thing, I can't partake of it in moderation. It just, that's my makeup. Let's assume drinking wine. Let's assume smoking, for argument's sake. I'm just going to use it. You can't use that as an example today, because everybody will say that it's not a good idea to smoke even in moderation. But let's assume that just for the sake of the argument.
Really?
Yeah. With regard to the issue of the sexual, there too, the correct approach is that a person should adopt the path of moderation. Should not have excessive lust for women, go to the extreme, nor should he go to the extreme of denial. Like, you see, that's the priest. The priests don't get married. That's not the correct approach. However, in this regard, the Torah did implement specific restrictions. It didn't just leave it at that. Let's put it this way. The Torah went further than that. It didn't just leave it. In certain cases, the Torah didn't go really much beyond the general teaching. For example, the Rambam talks about materialism. The Torah talks about materialism, clothing, acquisition of money, honor, things of that sort. So, when it, other than the general idea, there's no specific avera if a person overindulges, builds lavish houses and so on and so forth and cars, if he has the money. If he has the money, he's earned it legitimately, it's his money. And even in terms of the obligation to give miser, so he gives his 10%, he still has plenty of money. He still can overindulge. There's no further restrictions have been built into the halachic system, the halachic mechanisms. It is interesting to note, however, that when it comes to the sexual, it's not merely telling us this. There are many, many laws which are in effect to guide a person, to keep a person off the path of overindulgence. And, for example, look at all the many forbidden sexual relationships. Nida being the most prominent, because that's even with a woman who otherwise is permitted to you. Not to mention the forbidden adultery, a married woman. I mean, there's many reasons, obviously. That's not the only factor. Adultery is necessary to prohibit. Not merely because it controls man's sexual desire. I mean, it would destroy the whole society and the family and so on and so forth. It has many implications. But you do have, for example, the institution of Nida. And thus, on a certain level, before a person gets married, it is pretty absolute. Now, to the prohibition against contact with a Nida. V'elisha benidas tamasa lo sikra ve'le legala sarvasa. You may not come close to her. That's what we call chibuk v'nishuk, hugging and kissing. The preliminary sexual activities are prohibited. Now, according to the Rambam, the Rambam holds the oraisa. So that would be interesting because it's basically a harkarka. It's basically designed to keep a... Because the iser, the serious violation of relations with a nida, kares, very serious violation, is only for sexual relations itself. Not for chibuk v'nishuk. I mean, it's an avera, of course. According to others, it's dirabanan. Well, the pasuk itself, the idea is in the pasuk, whether the actual mitzvah is from the Torah, or just the idea, and the chacham incorporated it, doesn't make that much difference as far as we're concerned. But that you have to recognize that truth. That's not going to an extreme. That's a recognition of human nature. And that's a perfect illustration of what we call exera. That you can't have one without the other. And that one thing inevitably will lead to another. If you know the nature of people, especially at a certain age in life, boys and girls, and their hormones are working and they're flaming with passion, so the only way to prevent that avera is you can't draw the line. It doesn't begin with bia. It begins with many, many other moves. It begins when you get with the social, when you get together for a certain type of socializing. And then there's contact. And there's affection. It could be minor, but one thing inevitably leads to another. And person has to recognize that. People deny it. They say, oh, I've never had any intention of doing this. What, you know, we just happened to be together, and we started, before you knew it, we had a little hug and a kiss, and before you knew it. But that's not the case. That's clearly the beginning. That's where it starts. And unconsciously, the person knows what he's doing. He's creating a situation from which it will then be inevitable, and then he'll say, well, I just overcome my passion. That's not the way it works. So there's no way. That's the problem in this society. They broke down all the barriers. That's why you have such tremendous problems with a teenage pregnancy, sexual diseases, and so on and so forth, which was unheard of in past generations, because you can't even make a rule prohibiting sexual relations today in secular society. And even if it was, you can't have people getting together and social and dancing and hugging and doing all these things, and that's so, it's, of course it's going to lead to sex. What's going to stop you? You have to understand man's makeup. So that's not an issue of going to an extreme. That's common sense. That's a good example, though. That is a good example of a rational approach to the area. This is a practical problem today. The basic hashkafa of the Torah on these things is that a person would get married young. Historically, the Jews in most communities, especially in the time when there was arranged marriages and other societal issues, in older times, it was different. I mean, the ideal was to get married young, and I guess it was easier to do so. There was a whole system worked out where perhaps the parents would support them for a few years, and it wasn't a matter that a person would spend so many years going to school and setting up his profession and so on and so forth before he could get married. So this is a tremendous problem in this society today, because there's a big gap. Up to the point where the sexual instinct is developed and powerful, till a person's about, say, 13, 14, whatever it is, so it's not a problem. But from the time that the sexual instinct comes and desire, a person has a desire and is attracted to girls, so the longer the waiting period between the time of the onset of the sexual and the time he can gratify it in a halakhically valid way, the longer the time, and obviously you're putting a person in a situation of danger. Because what can he do? What can he do to... There's no real way that he can satisfy his sexual desire without sinning. And it's a very serious averos over here. So then it's wise for a person. Either a person, an intelligent person who wants to live a Torah life, should seek out ways in which he can get married when he's younger, not to have to wait that long, obviously. Or if that's not in the works right now, yeah, then he should be very, very cognizant, be very careful that there's a tremendous danger he's going to fall into sins if he puts himself in that situation. Situations which even might not be usher. If it's usher, it's usher. But it's not. It's doing things that put you in a certain kind of a mood, that strengthen the desire and lead you to sin. That would be a perfect illustration. I mean, I'm addressing myself to the question that Jonah posed. Yeah, a person should be very careful in that area and should make up his own personal restrictions. Because you know yourself, the Torah can't legislate everything for every particular person, every particular situation. You can't have a thing like that. Ultimately, it's your own perfection. So, but if you have to be honest, the Torah legislation, the mitzvos, contain teachings. Like the Rambam is giving you the teaching of what the ideal is. The ideal is that a person should not go to the extreme. I want to come back to that a little bit. Maybe we'll continue that idea tomorrow. Because we haven't completed the Rambam yet. Because he gives examples of what a person should not do. But it's also important to know what you should do. And you're living in a society in which you're inundated with all of these temptations and things that increase lust and have a negative effect upon you, not a positive one. So it's endless. I can't think of all the particulars. You can walk out on the street in the summer. I mean, guys tell me you go to a college course, the girls dress in some colleges like they were at the beach. These become issues. So you may have to, in a personalized kind of way, you have to really know yourself and know how you're functioning and what situations are negative. And then you can make up your own rules to avoid those situations and so on and so forth. And then you may need some personal guidance on that. It's important, though, to get a general sense of what's intelligent, what would be cases of an intelligent approach, and what would be cases of a non-intelligent approach, which are not in line with the basic philosophy of the Torah. If a person before he's married is basically has to completely abstain, but that would not be, that's not because you've adopted the philosophy of a priest. That's not the same thing. The priest is abstaining because he has the idea that the indulgence itself is evil, which is a completely false idea. And it's a form of evil for man to live that way. It would be like a person, it would be like a person that's in a situation and he can't afford meat. He's working very hard, whatever it is, and he doesn't eat meat. It's not, that's not the same as the person who makes a decision not to eat meat because he thinks that depriving oneself is good. You have to look at it differently. You're in a situation right now. Your general philosophy of life is that you do want to live in accordance with moderation. You do intend to marry, to have a family, and to establish a relationship that's based on the principle of moderation. So you're not, the only point being that right now you're not in a position to do so. So that's the way life is. You may have to endure a certain amount of pain. That's the way the system is set up, so that it's not perfectly running for you at every given moment. At the age of 15, it's not possible yet for you to embrace that idea of moderation in the sexual. And you may be in a certain amount of pain. That's different. That's a challenge to you, and that's a good thing as well, because it teaches the soul, it gives you strength. Then you have to fight against your instincts. We're not saying that the life is such that a person is always going to be smooth and he doesn't have to fight against his instincts. That's a different parsha. This is an extremely important point to remember, because a lot of people take leniencies with the idea that, I have these strong desires and I can't get married yet and so on and so forth. So it's okay. Well, of course, everybody else is doing it. It's accepted. And, you could even say, look, the Rambam holds that you shouldn't go to extremes of denial and so on and so forth. You can create a whole fabric of all these rationalizations. That's not what the Rambam is talking about. A person, part of life is that there are times when you have to deprive yourself. And that deprivation is a good thing. The Rambam even talks about when you start out learning. Your attitude has to be that you're prepared to give up sleep and paspa melach and so on and so forth. That's a different kind of thing. There are times in life when a person does have to embrace an extreme position, as Morris pointed out. In the situation with regard to premarital, the Torah absolutely prohibits it. So that, what are you supposed to do? Well, you have to embark on a course, an intelligent course. If you embark on an intelligent course, you'll try to set up your life so that you're able to get married reasonably. That has to be, obviously, a major goal, to marry the correct person. And when and how, you have to use your intelligence. You don't want to put it off forever, obviously. But there will be a period of time in your life when it's not possible. You're not ready, or you may not even have the girl, or whatever, and she's not ready. There will be a time when you're waiting, and the waiting will be painful. And that is not contrary. That's not a bad thing. That's not what the Rambam is talking about. That you should seek to remove that and indulge so that it will be... That's not the case. It would be the case if that was your overall philosophy in terms of life in general. But no, you have the correct philosophy, except at this point in time, it can't be implemented. That's going to be true in virtually every area. So then you're going to deal with the phenomenon of deprivation, and then you have to fight the Yetzer. And to the contrary, you should direct the energies. First of all, take the correct steps so that you don't strengthen it, that you're not exposing yourself to greater temptation, which is pure stupidity in that situation. Unfortunately, that's what people do. You go to these shows, movies, etc., read these magazines, whatever, and all they do is make you feel miserable and increase your lust, which is stupid. The second thing is that you should redirect your energies, conquer the Yetzer. And the upside of this type of situation is that it if you use it properly, it can be a tremendous catalyst towards a greater involvement in learning and thinking. That uses up the energy, and it makes it much more easy to deal with the deprivation. That's the derech of the Torah. March 4th, Hashkafa, Yeshiva, in the morning. We're continuing with the Rambam in Hilchos Deos, pertaining to the idea of going to extremes. And the Rambam has laid out the basic objective in terms of one's dispositions, that one should direct oneself towards the path of moderation, which is the middle medium position between both extremes. The Rambam in chapter 3 talks about a certain type of a religious attraction to the extreme of denial. And he speaks out very strongly against this, that a person who says that since taiva, since kavod and so forth are an evil path, and remove a person from the world, which we said means that it also creates tremendous practical conflicts, makes his life miserable, because it's contrary to the natural order of things. So the person says that he will separate himself excessively and go to the other extreme. So the Rambam says that, he says that that's the pathway, that's the approach of the idolaters. Well, you see that's a very strong feature in all religions virtually, especially in Christianity. That sort of maintained that the bodily enjoyments per se are sinful. So the Rambam says that that person is considered to be a sinner, a chote. And the proof that he mentions is the case of the Nazir, who only abstained from wine. That's a very interesting point, because in general that person is not going to the extreme of asceticism. He took a neder in one area, the area of wine. And for that alone, that's a pleasure. You see from this that wine is a quote-unquote legitimate pleasure. And of course, only in the proper proportion, only in moderation. And obviously, if a person goes to the extreme, so that's not good. But in its proper context, wine is a legitimate pleasure. And one should not be monea himself. Of course, that doesn't mean to say that everybody has to drink wine. It means if it's a pleasure that you enjoy, either if you have it under control, and it then it's a beneficial thing. Of course, you could say, well, what's the point? So what am I? So I don't have wine. It would appear that if something is a legitimate pleasure and it's beneficial to you, so then it's really a good. And for a person to take the attitude that he's simply going to be monea himself from legitimate pleasures, that is to say that he's going to afflict himself for no legitimate reason. That's very important, because it could be for a legitimate reason. And that is due to the fact that a person might get caught up in certain types of addictions or excesses, let's put it this way. So then he has to cure himself, and in order to do so, he's going to experience affliction. That's true of any procedure. A person goes on an exercise. an exercise program. So it's going to be painful, at least at the outset. It may be painful even after he's in good condition. It doesn't necessarily mean it's always going to be pleasurable, but that's not affliction. That's not considered affliction. He's not afflicting himself. He may experience a certain amount of pain, but he's doing it for a positive purpose. So that's the idea over here, that attitude, that he's going to be monea himself, he's going to afflict himself for no good reason, simply because he wants to distance himself from the enjoyment, that is a sinful form of behavior. And let's continue now, because the question that this is going back to was the idea of a person establishing his own customs, personal stringencies, and so on and so forth, which the Torah did not command. So now the Rambam addresses...
Yeah.
Questions being raised. What do I mean? Can I elaborate on the idea of legitimate pleasures? Of course, yesterday we discussed illegitimate pleasures. So, for starters, something which is prohibited by the Torah, which the Torah saw fit to render into a prohibition, obviously it goes without saying that it's an illegitimate pleasure. Aside from that, though, in the realm of those things that are permitted, and there's much that's permitted, the Torah left plenty of room for a person to indulge himself. That's why the Ramban, that's his explanation of Kedoshim Tiyu, that you shall be holy. He takes up this point, that a person should not be a novel Bershus HaTorah, that is, someone who's a novel, someone who leads a corrupt or disgusting type of an existence with the permission of the Torah, which is to say that he's scrupulous in terms of the halachic, that a person can indulge himself in all of the physical pleasures and see to it that it all works out halachically, that everything is kosher, and even with women and so on and so forth, there's plenty of room for a person to find the permitted. So just because something is permitted does not mean that it's legitimate for the sake of this discussion. Because it could be completely permitted, and yet it's a violation of Kedusha. So, just I'll give a very quick or a rough description. For starters, legitimate would mean that it's something which is not harmful to the person. Let's take, for example, playing a game of basketball. Okay, now the person doesn't waste his whole time with basketball. That's a problem. A person is completely consumed with basketball, playing and watching and reading about it. So then, obviously, he's not directing his energies towards the real good. So then he's got a problem. But let's say a person has a good Seder worked out. He learns, and then goes to college, and so forth. He's on a good path, but he realizes that he needs a certain amount of relaxation. And this is, so he plays basketball. Whatever, two nights a week, three nights a week, whatever it is. Because it becomes difficult, you know, to make objective criteria of what would be reasonable. But let's say it's reasonable, because it's not, he's not using it, he's not taking away time from learning, he's not taking away time from his responsibilities. But it's something that he enjoys, and it's good physical exercise. So that's something which I would call a legitimate pleasure. It makes him feel good, and that's very important to a person. Aside from the exercise is very important, aside from the pure physical benefits, the psychological benefits, and it rejuvenates a person. That's why a person should not have a negative attitude towards pleasures, quote-unquote. I'm talking about the non-learning pleasures. A person goes on a hike, climbs a mountain. If it's in the right context, so it could be very, very, very useful. You shouldn't underestimate, because as I said, exercise is very good, and the psychologically it's very good for a person. A good workout puts you in a completely different psychological frame of mind. I find it to be the case, and most people I speak to. I jog every day, and aside from the physical benefits, I consider the psychological benefits, the emotional benefits, to be very important. And there's also, additionally, there is when you engage in something which is enjoyable experience, then there is a certain rejuvenation. You sort of feel good. You feel good about life. And that is that some people are only capable of so much quote-unquote work or learning this, that, keeping your schedules, and you sort of get worn down. And you need a little rejuvenation, a little fun. So aside, I'm extending the concept now that a person needs fun. I'm sure we've all had that experience after a couple of months of learning in college that you have the vacation. So what's the point of a vacation? And it does play an important psychological role. With these things, of course, you've got to be very, very careful because it's a very subtle difference between what I would call legitimate and where you're starting to just indulge in the making the fun, the pleasure becomes an end in itself, becomes the way of life, becomes the ultimate good. That's why I'm being very careful over here. But within reason, I'm not telling you, we're not talking about vacation, you know, because there again, you're going to have to get into the issue of what's appropriate and what's not appropriate. So that's why I'm taking something which I consider to be neutral, halachically, basketball. There's no issue of anything being usher over here. The only question, of course, as I'm saying, is that if it's interfering with the important activities, it's got to be something then which is a background. It's a backgrounder. It's in your life. It's not first and foremost, but, or yeah, any sport, you play a game of racquetball, whatever, if you enjoy it, then it's positive. It's very positive. And it gives you a renewed strength, and you can conduct your other activities in a more efficient manner. In this respect, I would say it's legitimate. It's a good thing. It's a good. And one should view it as a good. And I would go so far as to say that it's even Avodas Hashem. Can be an Avodas Hashem. Can be a service of God. Can be, quote-unquote, a mitzvah. In accordance with the doctrine that the Rambam proceeds to work out in Deos, which we'll have to go into in more discussion, more depth. It's a very important idea that if a person has why it can be a good, and we'll go into the concept more. It's a very important concept. It's not that it's a good in its own right. All right, this is my opinion. I'm not saying, now many people would say, that it's a good in its own right because man should be happy and you're enjoying something. And what's wrong with that? So that itself is the good. Many people, that's as far as they can go. And, you know, they envision if they can get away and get on a little vacation and they get a chance to play some game or golf or whatever it is they like. And they enjoy it. So that's a good. They feel life is good. That's not what I'm saying. That is not what I'm saying. I don't think that that is the view of the Torah. Only because, not that there's anything wrong. I wouldn't condemn people like that. I don't mean to condemn a person. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with it. But we have a different idea as to the good. This is crucially important. Very important point that we're discussing now in Hashkafa. Very, very important. Is that our view of the good is totally different than that of the Hamon Am that can't envision the true good. And even if they should go on a vacation, you'll see a lot of people go on vacation, they want to go to a place where there's minions and where there's learning every day, Daf Yomi, and then they go off and they do the activities. It makes them feel good that they, in addition, they learn and so on and so forth. Now, that's not that type of an attitude. I'm talking about ordinary people. That's not what I'm saying. The fact that they go on a vacation And at the same time, they continue, they do some learning. That's not because they view learning as the true good. I think for most people, it's simply because they have a certain sense of religious responsibility, which is fine. I'm not critiquing that. I'm merely saying that the average individual does not view Torah in that light. The average individual views it as part of the religious system, which I've got to keep, if he's religious. But that is not the good. It's the good in a different way, because you're serving God, and God will reward you, and so forth. But in terms of the way I look at this life and this world, they don't view Torah as being the real thing, the real enjoyment that one should pursue. They don't view Torah as being, interestingly, ironically enough, they don't view Torah as being the end in itself. They view it as being a means to being rewarded by God, because I fulfilled my responsibilities. But basically, in their own mind, they're good. Look, people are having fun. They're enjoying that. That's really good. But I sacrifice that. That's not what I'm talking about. That's not the way I look at it. The good for man does not consist in all of these activities that we're talking about. The good for man is to be involved in a higher activity of perfecting himself, essentially through opening his mind and perceiving truth and getting what we call closer to Hashem, to experience that phenomenon, the desire to explore God's universe and get a greater Yedias Hashem. Those types of activities are the real good. That's what man was designed for, and that's the ultimate experience in life. It's a much greater experience than the experience of the ordinary pleasures.
Rabbi?
That is the ultimate good. The Torah is not commanding us to keep the mitzvos and to desist from other things and to study Torah because we're supposed to sacrifice these things for this concept of service. The Torah is commanding us to do it because it's directing us towards that which constitutes the greatest fulfillment for man in a real, concrete, existential manner. And thus, they're far superior. You can't compare the joys of Torah and the Torah way of life to the quote-unquote joys of the non-Torah way of life. I'm trying to say
what about
that...
psychological?
So what I'm saying is that I'm not looking at the sport as the game as a good in itself. It's not a good in itself. The way I'm looking at it, it's the same... Would you say that eating a nutritious meal is a good? Of course it's a good. Is it a good in itself? Intrinsically a good? That a person has worked himself to the point where he is perfected in eating. He eats the correct amount and he eats nutritious foods. It's a perfect nutritional system. It's good. Is it a good in itself? That's my question. It's the same idea as health. And this would be another illustration of the difference between the Torah outlook and the societal outlook. And that is that health. Most people have the idea that health is the ultimate good. That if you have your health, you have everything. That's what they say. But of course, you can see the absurdity of such a view. Of course, health is very important. And without it, you may not be able to do anything. But the importance of health is not because health per se is a good. A person can be perfectly healthy. It doesn't mean he has a good life. But health is a precondition of the good life. So in conjunction with the good life, health is a good thing. But if a person has a miserable, or let's say he has an evil life, so then health is a bad thing. For example, a healthy Russia is a bad thing because we wish he would be sick, because the sicker he is, the less harm he can do. So again, you have to look at, go through the list, and you will see how Yahadus, Judaism, differs with the philosophy of the society. See, the big one that everybody talks about, and it affects everybody, is... It's easier to see, anyone can see this point, that health is not the end in itself, and nutrition is not the end in itself. Thus, playing basketball. Well, it's playing basketball. you will have people that make their whole life revolve around basketball. But to any intelligent person, it's the same thing. It's a form of exercise. It's something which gives a certain amount of psychological gratification. Is that the end of life? That a person should engage in an activity like that? Well, when I say it's a legitimate, I say it's legitimate, it's something which a person might need no differently than he might need, than he does need, a nutritious meal. It puts him in a good condition, which renders him appropriate then to engage in the real good for man, the service of God, we'll use that generic term, those activities which come under the heading of the service of God. That's the real good for man. So all of the, now well, that's exactly what the Rambam is talking about. We have to approach everything else in our life, because part of our responsibility is to keep ourselves in the most appropriate condition in which we can serve God. And if a person is, God did not create us that way without needs. God created us, Bari Nefashos Rabos, V'chesronan. God created us with needs. We have needs. And they must be satisfied. And if they're not satisfied, so then we're not going to be healthy, physically healthy and emotionally healthy. So thus, all of those, not to mention Parnassa. Everybody has a distorted attitude on these areas. The area of Parnassa becomes an end in itself. You'll see, most people, the average individual, that's his main pursuit, his main focus in life is his portfolio and how much he's making and money constantly. But that too is important. But to have achieved perfection in the realm of Parnassa, you have a perfect means, a livelihood. Is that an end in itself? No, it's a condition. It's a necessary condition. It's a precondition for you to engage in what the real purpose of life is about. Now, very few people get beyond that point. They get stuck in the means. And they take the means and they make it into an end. That's the biggest failing of people. They get completely caught up in the activities which are not intended to be the ends. And it's just the means. And they get stuck on the means. So the legitimate pleasure is important for a person. If he deprives, the reason why the Rambam is telling you not to go to the extreme is because it's a completely distorted concept of what the good is. You have to keep your eyes, your mind, focused on the good, and the good demands that you are in a certain condition so that you can have the good. I view it, I'll just use an example, for let's assume, for argument's sake, the person, the Olympic coach, for him the whole thing, let's assume that this was the whole purpose, to win a gold medal. Okay, in their world it is, in our world of course it's not, but I'm just going to use it as an example. So therefore, you have to be in the most appropriate condition to compete. That means how much you sleep and what you do. It encompasses like a training regimen. When they're training, it really covers virtually every aspect of their life. I mean, a real dedicated coach will want them to eat properly, get the right amount of sleep, and what to do, what not to do, what to avoid, and so on and so forth. So these activities themselves are not the ends. They're only significant in terms of being the means. That's why he'll say when his athletes are eating, they're involved in the sport. Of course, everything they're doing is directed towards that goal. So then they're always involved in the goal. So even sleeping. Even if he approaches sleeping, he doesn't just sleep when he feels like it, but the doctors have told him the correct amount of sleep that he should have, how much he should sleep, and so on and so forth, and he conforms to that pattern. So then even in sleeping, he's serving the team. Because everything that he's doing is under the control of those factors. Now that's pretty much, that's a rough description. But the Rambam uses that idea. The true servant of God, in all of his ways, b'chol d'rachecha de'ehu, in all your ways you should know him, which means that this principle is the governing principle of all your activities. What you eat, and what you choose to do as a parnasa. Is the purpose of the parnasa just to make money? Or is the purpose to create a situation you need, and in which you then will be able to serve God? If you, and most people want to come to that, well, they choose something which they're good at, they like, and where they can make the most money, and so on and so forth. But they don't factor in the purpose. Not just the purpose, there's two purposes. The immediate purpose is to establish a parnasa. But the ultimate purpose is what's the purpose of having a parnasa? To put you in a situation in which you can serve God. So if a person is just engaged, for example, even in health, some people get fixated on health and nutrition and exercise and so forth. They make that, but that's not a service of God, because for many people, as I said, most people are involved in taking something which is a means and making it into an end. You see, that they take it to extremes. A bodybuilding and this, an absolute, a degree of perfection which is completely worthless and unnecessary. So, if the person is engaged in proper nutrition, is that a good? Is that a mitzvah? Why is he engaged in proper nutrition? In and of itself, it's not the mitzvah. It's only in the context of someone who wants to serve God and realizes that in order to do so, he has to be in the most appropriate condition. So then, all the activities that he's engaged in order to produce that result, they themselves constitute the service of God. Because it's directed towards that purpose. So that's what the Rambam says. Even when this person is sleeping at night, he's involved in his sleep becomes a mitzvah. Because it's not just ordinary sleep. It's something which he's engaged in for the sake of serving God. It's an interesting concept of Avodas Hashem. It's not, aside from the mitzvahs, it's not just that which is a mitzvah. There's a broader idea over here. The mitzvahs are certain objective imperatives that God has established, that guides everybody in the nation. But within a person's, not every activity was formalized, objectified. You can't have a mitzvah of what a person should eat. Other than the general idea is a mitzvah, b'chol d'rachecha de'ehu, lidamos l'Hashem, to mold yourself, so to speak, to imitate, so to speak, to practice the ways, the derech Hashem. That's the general mitzvah. Within that context, everything a person does, if it's done for the proper objective, becomes a service of God. So that's getting back now to what would be the legitimate pleasure would be in that context. That you know yourself and you're sort of regulating your life and you're gearing yourself towards the true good. But you know that at this point in time, this is what I can do. This is what I'm capable of doing. And that's also very, very important. It's very, very important that a person regulate his activities in an intelligent manner. Just like if the goal was to run a marathon, let's say. So a person just starting out wouldn't start out and try to run 10 miles a day. It's ridiculous. He'd fail. So you got to go at your pace and gradually increase it. Now, you've got to be intelligent about it. You can't be too lazy and easy on yourself. Otherwise, you're not going to get anywhere. On the other hand, you can't be overly demanding, otherwise you're going to break down. The same would be true with regard to learning and mitzvahs and so forth. A person should be realistic. His goal is to increase, but he's got to do it in a realistic manner. If he's fully determined and he goes about it in a realistic manner, he will succeed. Because the same things apply to the realm of the psyche, the mind, the ability to learn, the ability to be involved in abstract ideas. Will increase and increase dramatically if you go about it in the correct way. If you apply yourself and you're not lazy about it, and you push yourself in an intelligent way, you have the resources. They'll come into fruition and so forth, and then you're going to transform yourself. It's got to happen. It will happen. So, but you've got to go about it in an intelligent way. In that context, if a person knows himself, he it would be foolish for him to then automatically seek to... Hold on. It would be foolish of the person to deprive himself, and it would be self-destructive, because you're harming yourself. Part of your ability depends upon keeping yourself psychologically fit. If you wear yourself out, for example, you're going to stay up hours and then deprive yourself of sleep, and because you have this thing, I want to learn 20 hours a day and learn at night, do things which are unrealistic at this point in your life. So you're just wearing yourself down, and it's a self-defeating course. So it's nothing holy about it. In the same way, if you deprive yourself from foods that you like or other activities that you like, so what have you gained? Oh, then it must be appealing to a certain from emotion. Because this is not a Jewish idea, but it's become very deeply ingrained that he's a tzaddik. He gives up, he sacrifices, that whole notion. He gives up a pleasure. If a person takes upon himself that attitude to afflict himself with the deprivations, then it's sinful and it's foolish. He's hurting himself, no differently than if he was planning for an athletic activity, and he's depriving himself of things that would be beneficial. So it's like he has an injury, and he insists on working out anyways, and he doesn't care about the pain. But he's foolish, because the doctors will say you're only hurting yourself. Take off and wait until it heals. So the Rambam, getting back to the Rambam, says, "Lefichach tzivu chachamim." Therefore, the Chacham commanded, "Shelo yimna adam atzmo, ela midvarim shemana haTorah bilvad." That the person should not deprive himself. Very careful. Don't deprive yourself, except from things that the Torah prohibited you. "Velo yia oser atzmo b'nedarim," and he should not create prohibitions for himself through vows, ubishfuos, al devarim hamutarim, on things that are mutter. Kach amru chachamim, thus said the chachamim, lo daicha masha asra Torah, it's not enough for you what the Torah prohibited, ela she'ata oser alecha devarim acherim, but you prohibit upon yourself other things. Ubachlal hazeh, and included in this category, Elu Shemis Anin Tamid, those who fast constantly. Einun B'derech Tovah, there's certain people that engage in fasting all the time. So that's not the correct path. The Asru Chacham Shiyehe Adam Masagif Atzma B'tainis, and the Chacham prohibited that a person afflicts himself with fasting. The Alkal Azvarim Elu, and concerning all of these things, v'chayotzei behen, and the like, tziva Shlomo v'yamar, Shlomo commanded and said, al tehi tzadik harbe, don't be too much of a tzadik, v'al teschakam yoser, and don't be such a big chacham, lama tishomein, why should you be desolate? So apparently he holds that Shlomo was addressing himself to this phenomenon, where a person has the capability of taking upon himself additional prohibitions through a neder, you see that by nazir, or through a shvua, a person can do that. And then it may be wise at some points for a person to, I know people that have done that. For example, I know people that have taken a neder to stop smoking. They use that mechanism. So, and it doesn't always work either. And sometimes I've seen those very same people breaking down and being matir the neder. So the Rambam is not saying that you can never do that. There are times when you may want to do it, and it might be beneficial. That you have to know. You have to know yourself, or you have to consult with someone that's more expert on these types of matters. But the general rule, however, the general idea that it's a positive thing to afflict oneself, to deprive oneself, to go to the extremes of negating legitimate pleasures, that is a sinful activity, and it does